Welcome to Abound in Hope, a podcast from Imprint Church. Our goal is to help you apply the hope of the gospel of Jesus Christ to everyday life. Well, hey there, traveling partners. Welcome back to Abound in Hope. It's been a second. I am Rex Gorman, and I'm sitting here with...
Hey, I'm Tom Regan.
Tom kicked off our first podcast recording in a little while the way that he always does by eating a bunch of snacks right before. So if something's going on
there.
You hear
anything crunchy, you'll those M&Ms.
Snack King Cole is back in the building. We are going to start doing something a little different here on the podcast. Last year, most of the year was spent telling people stories. And we had a series we did called The Word of Their Testimony. And where does that come from, Tom?
That comes from the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
The saints overcome the evil one by the...
How do they overcome the evil one?
By the word of their testimony,
by the blood of the Lamb.
Help me out here. Yeah,
it's a revelation.
The word of their testimony.
Yeah, Revelation 12.
Faithful unto death.
That's right. It's the blood of the Lamb, the word of their testimony, and not loving their lives unto death. And the whole idea was basically that there is a lot of power just in celebrating our stories of what God has done. The testimony that we belong to Jesus is how we overcome the evil one, and that's powerful stuff. So we are. I don't know if this is the kickoff of another.
Where their testimony? Where their testimony? Phase two.
Phase two.
Yeah. Part two.
Yeah. Whatever. I got nothing else to say. Anyway, I don't know if it's that or what, but in light of that, we do want to share some more stories, and we have a very special guest today. Very special guest. Who are you?
I'm so glad I get to be very special, not just special. I'm Suzanne Hagelin.
Hey, Suzanne Hagelin.
Yeah, I'm prayer lead here at Imprint in the Woodinville section of the church.
Yeah, Suzanne, you started your position about the same time I started my position.
Yeah.
I remember that because we came in around the same time. So
fall of 2018.
Fall of 2018. Mm-hmm. So it's been a wild ride, you know. Suzanne is fantastic. Suzanne, if you let her know of a need, prepare for her to intensely listen and then to intensely pray and intercede for you on your behalf.
And ask how she can be.
And ask how she can be.
Specifically.
But generally, it'll also happen immediately, which is great. I love that you're so quickly driven to prayer and that. That's really encouraging. If you see Suzanne on a Sunday, you should definitely come talk to her. She'd be happy to do so. But Suzanne, so far, all we know is that you've been at Imprint for 5 years.
That's all there is?
That's all there is. Okay, never mind.
I mean, I know more than that.
We'll see you next week. No, I meant
in
the context of what's here. But where did you grow up? Where did Suzanne Hagelin, where have you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?
I'm human.
Okay, that's good.
An earthling.
Yes.
I was born in the United States, but I always say that I grew up in Mexico because that was kind of the formative years.
Okay.
So when I had just had my 11th birthday, we moved to Mexico City.
Where were you born in the United States?
I was born in Texas.
In Texas, okay.
And then
I won't hold that against you.
No,
I'm just kidding. Anyway.
Thank you. Yeah. At the age of two, we moved to Oklahoma, which is where my parents are from.
Okay.
And lived there again until I was basically through my 10th year. And then we moved to Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
What led you guys there?
My dad's job.
Okay.
So he had a computer service bureau. He and a couple of guys started a company. He was an IBM software engineer, started a company in the States, and there was another branch that started in Mexico City that wasn't doing well. So he went down to, quote-unquote, close the company.
Okay.
But the investors there talked him into staying. In the meantime, there was a hostile merger, takeover of his company in the States, and he realized that he was either, going to be looking for work or why not try Mexico City, which was kind of an adventure.
That is an adventure, yeah.
And
from so Oklahoma to Mexico City is quite a cultural difference, I will
definitely
say.
A difference. And we were living out in the country in Oklahoma, so,
Yeah, so you went from a rural Central America, not Central American, Central United States, like Midwest environment, Southern Midwest environment, to a highly populated urban
metropolis.
That's interesting. What did that do to you as an 11-year-old? How did you feel about that transition?
Well, I mean, I was excited for the adventure.
Yeah.
I've been, I tend to be a person who likes to try new things. So.
Okay.
And I had no idea what to expect. So just was along for the ride. I was excited to learn a new language.
That's cool.
We moved into a house that's downtown Mexico City. It's in the Zona Rosa, which is like really near the tourist zone and the business, like the main business zone. Okay. And we moved into a house that was 500 years old and had these elaborate stained glass.
House 500? Was 500 years old.
500, I think so. That's what they told us.
Oh my goodness.
It was an old Spanish colonial house.
That's amazing.
You know, stained glass windows, and the ceilings were like 15 feet high, and it was two-story. And in the living room, which was double height, more like what we would think of as three stories high, there was a wrought iron chandelier that's bigger than this table in like its diameter.
And
so
for the listeners, this table is probably about 5.5 feet long.
It might have been a 7-foot diameter. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And it was very heavy.
So it's basically an old mansion that you lived in.
Yeah.
Yeah, you moved into a
strange
a house that was twice as old as the United States. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are a lot of tremors in Mexico City, and so anytime there was even a small tremor, that
get
big
away from
chandelier
that chandelier
would start swinging, you know, and it
somebody's
was a bit unnerving.
Yeah. I believe that.
It never fell while we were there, although I wondered.
Yeah.
Was it a good house for a hide and go seek?
I don't know.
I think if you have to think about it for that long, it's probably not.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe not so much. We did have, a really long staircase with black marble stairs, and we used to make this bundle of pillows and blankets, and my sister and my brother and I, we'd sit together like a train and wrap that thing around us and then go
Slide down.
Stairs.
Kevin McAllister style. I like it.
So that was fun. But
So backing up just a little bit before we spend too much time in Mexico,
There's more time to spend there.
Okay. Did you grow up in a family that went to church or that believed in Jesus? What did that look like pre-Mexico? And then I'd love to hear how that affected your faith as well in Mexico.
Pre-Mexico, when I was little, we would go to my grandparents' church, which was where my dad took us. And, my impression of it was that it was a pretty... I don't want to say dead because I don't know that, but I didn't have much of an impression of God, of Jesus, certainly, other than I remember seeing a picture on a little classroom wall of like a cartoon of Jesus. I remember that existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a boring place.
It was just a dry experience for a little, a little person.
Yeah. And people would get baptized at the age of 8 and then you could have communion. And so I wanted to do that so I could, because I had seen this little girl who had just gotten her baptism,
she got
to take communion, and she held her little pinky out like this, you know, and crook her finger like this to take the communion cup. And I remember
He's
being jealous.
Up a fancy hands.
And I was jealous, and so I wanted to do this just so I could hold my pinky that way and take the little communion cup.
That's about
how much it meant to
me. Okay, so it meant pretty much nothing to you. What about with your parents? Was it sort of a thing that they did, or was it meaningful to them?
For my dad, it was just something he did for his parents.
Okay.
For my mom, I think she did that for him, but her faith was sincere. But I didn't know that at the time. I found over the years more and more about her faith. She was very quiet about her faith.
Okay. So church was just sort of a thing you guys did, a social club, a way of seeing grandparents and that kind of thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. What about, did your move to Mexico... did that affect your faith at all? What happened there? I'd love to know.
Well, we moved and we'd only been there a few months.
Okay.
And we had just started going to a school that was like an experimental school. It was Montessori. It was called Sunny Hill, and it was patterned after some school in England, which was a similar name. I can't remember what it was supposed to be. But anyway.
It'd be Rainy Hill in England, though. So. Anyway, sorry.
Probably. No, there was some... trend, you know. Anyway, we'd only been going there a few months, and they had preschool through sixth grade, and they were just starting a seventh grade. They're kind of like trying to grow with the kids growing up. So I was supposed to be in seventh grade because I had skipped a grade, and they didn't have a classroom for me, so they put me in with like this group of kids. But anyway, my littlest brother, there were five of us, three boys and two girls. My littlest brother had just turned 3, and he was eligible for the preschool. And so they said, you know, would you like to put him in preschool? And my mom was checking it out because she was worried about it. And she actually went and watched, you know, observed the school and went through this whole process to feel like, okay, it'll be safe. And there was a school bus, which was just a little van. It held about you know, 12 kids. And so the first day that he went to school was also the first day that they had added a facility in a different part of the city. So the school took two of us, there were four of us in this school, two of us to one facility and two to the other. And so so his first day,
mm-hmm.
he was a three-year-old in a preschool class, and mm-hmm. they had two recesses. My sister had one recess, and she went looking for him in the second recess
mm-hmm.
and couldn't find him. And they searched the whole school for him, and they couldn't find him. And then she insisted that they go to the swimming pool area, which was locked,
mm-hmm.
closed. And it was locked, and they and she kept saying, we have to look in there. And so she, because she was throwing a tantrum,
mm-hmm.
they finally went and got the key, and they opened it up.
How old was your sister?
Eight. Almost. Was she eight? Yeah. She, yeah, so they went and got the key, and they unlocked it, and he was in the pool.
Mm.
And she found him. And she said...
Drowned.
He was drowned. Some workers had been working on the pool. They wanted to take an unapproved break. So they put a rock at the in the door to prop it open. And then later on, they came back and just moved the rock, you know, because I guess they got their stuff. Or I don't know what they did, but they didn't notice.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first day of school.
First day.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, and it was a pretty so... Every one of us has like a different story, which I mentioned in the gospel, not the gospel and mental health. It was the practicum, priesthood of believers. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that when I talked about grief.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to mention a little bit about what happened, but just I can't do it justice, and
I
don't need to. But
absolutely, yeah.
So my younger brother, 5 years younger, and I were in the one school, and we didn't know what was happening, but something was off. I saw my teacher run out into his sports car, and he took off like the house was on fire, you know, and a couple of my new friends were just joking, cracking jokes. And I remember I turned to them and I was like, stop it. You don't know what could be happening. It could be your own brother.
Mm.
And then... Mm. My other brother had already gone, so because I was there full day, he was there half day. So he'd already gone, but apparently they took him back to that school and they left him there. They sent all the kids home, except for us. So I was at my facility by myself with mm-hmm. a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and David was at the other facility by himself, running around, trying to figure out what to do. He actually ran past the room where they had put my brother's body under a sheet.
My gosh. This ran like by the most dysfunctional thing ever.
They ran by it several times, and it wasn't until about 4 years later that he suddenly realized what that was.
What that was. Yeah.
And my older brother, who was 15 at the time, or maybe, yeah, I think he was 15, he was at the American school, and he got a message to come to the office. Came to the office, and they said, you have to go to your brother's school, and here's the bus routes. He didn't speak Spanish.
Oh, my God.
And they gave him these bus routes, like three or four buses, to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know why, but he went out, and it took him a couple hours to get there, but he got there. When he mm-hmm. got to the school, he went in, and he was looking all over. He finally found a room where these adults were meeting, and he opened the door and said, I got this message to come here to my brother's school. What's going on? And one of them turned around and they said, your brother is dead. Go home.
Oh, my.
And he walked out the door.
Oh, my God.
And then I don't know who he could ask how to get home, but it took him hours to get home by the bus.
What in the world?
Yeah. So I was hanging out without knowing what was happening, but actually I knew something had happened.
Mm-hmm.
To my brother. I just didn't know which one. And I don't know why I knew that. That was just my conviction. So they ended up taking me back to that facility. And of course, by then, no one else was there. It was just me and this teacher, you know. And then she said, I have something to tell you. And I said, and she was just sobbing. And I said, I already know, which wasn't true. But I felt like I had to say something because she was so upset. And so then she just said, I'm so sorry. And she just was, you know, hugging me. And I was just sitting there like a stone thinking, what do I do? Anyway, so finally they took me home. So these van drivers were taking, currying us back and forth, you know, without, I mean, every sibling in a different place. And apparently it's because they hadn't got a hold of my mother. And they didn't want to send us home and for her to see that my youngest brother was not there. So that's why they kept this circus going on. And they left messages. In the meantime, my dad, they had gotten a hold of him right away. They brought him in. And for the next, I don't know, 12 hours, they took him from one location to another. It was the police department. It was lawyers things and then some official things, and he had to identify the body, and they went through the entire process of taking care of a death with my dad. And he got back to our house at about, I don't know, 8 p.m. or something. I mean, it took that long to do this, which my dad says, even though it was really hard, that considering what that process is like in Mexico, it was actually a kindness for them to push that through, because it could have taken so long and been so many visits. But in the end, when they took me home, I came in the door. I apparently was the last one there. And my mom and my sister, my 5-year-old brother, they were all just weeping. And I came in, you know, and my mom's grabbing at us. And I'm still thinking, oh, you know, like I saw David, I thought, oh, well, it's not David. And then I realized who it was. And I didn't know how he had died. And I wasn't sure he was dead. I just thought he probably was.
And because then, the lady who told you and hugged you and was crying never actually verbalized it?
She never actually said the words. She just said,
I'm
sorry.
I know.
I know, because I didn't know what to say. And I was feeling like I probably knew. I know. It was poorly done. But it was just a horrible scene. So anyway, then David said, well, we'll still see him again, won't we? And my mom said, no, honey. And he said, but he'll come back. She said, no, honey.
This is a 5-year-old brother who said that.
And my sister, who was 8, kept saying, but he's okay. He's okay. And she said, honey. But the thing that we didn't know, that I found out, you know, decades later, was that when she, oh, I'm sorry, it's hard to say this.
It's okay.
When she came into where the swimming pool was and she saw him in the water, she then saw him across from the pool, it like in his spirit. And he was saying, it's okay, Gingy. That's what he called her. He said, it's okay, Gingy. I'm okay. So she had that comfort immediately. So she was trying to communicate that to us as a little girl. And I don't think any of us got it. I mean, she must have been in her 40s when she told me that again. She's like, don't you remember? And I was like, wow, no, I don't think I knew that. But anyway, so there's like blanks in my memory of that evening. But I know that they ended up giving me a tranquilizer, a doctor did, and they put me to bed. And I had a dream in the night of God. It was like meeting the God of the Old Testament. And I was in this, I don't know, spiritual realm that was just like dark clouds. It was just gray, fluffy clouds. It wasn't like emptiness. There was fullness there. And he spoke to me. And as he spoke, I could see his words sinking into the gray cloud. And he said, tell your mother that Philip is okay. He's with me. So I knew where he was. When I woke up and I told my mom, she said, do you know who that was? And to my childish shame, I said, no. Don't know why. I just felt awkward and I said no, which is so dumb. And I suffered over that for years. I felt like a traitor. But she said, that was God. And she told me decades later, that was like the only thing that got her through. And she told me that in the years after that, that at least for a little while, she was pretty suicidal, which I, you know, I didn't know.
Yeah. Why would you? Yeah.
Why would I know, little girl? So that happened on December 13th. It was right before Christmas, our first Christmas in Mexico. And before we had Christmas, we flew up to the States for a funeral and to bury him. And then came back and, quote unquote, celebrated Christmas.
Yeah.
Which was difficult. A joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
Like, Christmas was just awful.
Yeah, I understand.
Meaningless.
Yeah. You went through emotions.
Actually, I didn't. Emotions, I didn't. Yeah. That's.
I just mean in general, like with, and I've been in those situations as well where there's a tragedy right before something. And sometimes it's actually just doing
Just walking through it.
The thing.
Yeah.
Just to do it. Yeah. And there is some value to that. So you guys leave the States and immediately you have this intense tragedy that happens. And also immediately you are met with the reality of a God. Was that was sort of the first time that it was like, okay, well, there is something behind this. This isn't just a thing that we do. When I'm talking about that, I mean like church, et cetera. Was that the first experience you had where it was obvious that there was something?
Or did you not know it was God because you told your mom? No.
I knew who it was.
Okay, but you just didn't say.
I know. And she said, do you know who that is? Who that was? I said no. And I felt bad because I did
know. You did know it was God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did know. And I don't know that it wasn't a surprise to me that he spoke to me. And I don't think that I didn't believe in him. I think that I had a childish knowledge of God. It was just there. You know, it wasn't a big part of my life. It was part of the routine. But I wasn't surprised when he spoke to me. And I mean, it definitely anchored me. But I didn't realize that I was really lacking. Like I said, I felt like I met the God of the Old Testament. I did not know Jesus, and I didn't know that I didn't know him. But that, after that, it was really hard to go back to that school, and we only finished out the school year there. We didn't stay longer. And after that, they put me in, following the lead of some other parents, they put me in an all-girls Catholic school. And I took a crash course of Spanish for 2 weeks to try to be ready for that.
Okay.
Which is kind of a joke.
Yeah. Muy bien.
Gracias. And one of the girls who I'd kind of been friends with at that school was also going there. We were going to be in the same grade. So we went to that school. We hung out together during recess for 2 weeks. And then at the end of 2 weeks, we went to the bathroom and she turned to me and as she was washing her hands and she said, so I think that it's better if we each find our own friends. So leave me alone. And she walked out. And so then I had no one.
Yeah. Yikes.
So this process in my life of moving to Mexico, which I don't blame Mexico for.
Yeah, of course.
You know, the fact that I was there didn't cause a tragedy, even though it'd be easy to...
Yeah, but
mistakenly it could make that connection.
It could have happened in Oklahoma as well.
Well, that's it. Yeah. I mean, these things can happen wherever. You don't want them to.
No, of course not.
But I lost my culture. I lost my language. I lost my friends. I lost my sense of belonging. I lost a sense of safety and home. And I lost a great deal in my family. It was like as if someone had thrown a grenade right in our own little family gathering, right in the middle, and it blew us all back, and we're all wounded and filled with shrapnel. and nobody helping anyone else. And I tried to step up and be a help. So I took on my younger sister and brother and basically tried to kind of be their support mom, if you will. And my youngest brother, Philip, you know, when my when he was born, my mom was very ill for a long time. And so I took care of him a lot. So it was more than just losing a sibling. I was like one of his daily caretakers, even though I was so young and tiny. And he was really big. So anyway, they looked to me for comfort, for just talking things through, for someone to play with, for whatever. I mean, it's like my childhood ended on that day. And sometime in the like week or two, a few weeks after his death, I had my like my own personal little crisis, which I was very quiet about. But my way of my cry for help was that I locked myself in my closet, which had a key. And I that was right before dinner, and I didn't show up for dinner. And I thought, they'll miss me, and they'll say, where's Suzanne? Poor thing, you know. And no one did.
Oh, my gosh.
And no one came to look for me. And then they all went to bed. And so I unlocked the door in the middle of the night and came out and went to bed. And that was the moment when I lost the ability to ask my family for help.
So your parents were, before your brother died, were they emotionally aloof, distant, unavailable?
No, my family's pretty loving. And
but
you know,
did your parents become that way after he died? Because to not to, for you to feel as a young child, I've got to step up and mother my younger siblings. There must be some sense of they're not getting what they need from the parents.
No,
and then for your parents to not even notice that you're gone.
Which, you know, they can't hear that. I mentioned that to them and they were like, oh, no, honey, you must be mistaken. I'm sure we would notice. And I know what she means, what they mean by that.
Of course.
No, they were very loving. They were involved. After the death, my dad was always at work. My mom was very depressed. She got a job teaching, just to have something to do to get out of the house. But she was just barely coping. So she couldn't, she didn't have a lot to give.
Yeah. I mean, I think the grief process often does that. It often kind of hollows people out, I know, for a long time. But to feel that way, you know, as a young lady, like you don't have any kind of support, that had to be heartbreaking.
It was.
So you find yourself, okay, I can't ask for help from my family.
It wasn't a conscious
decision.
Yeah,
of course. But you're just feeling like that's not going to do anything. You know, you're feeling somewhat abandoned here.
Yeah, I know. I lost a voice. I simply couldn't ask. One of the things, like I can identify with Jeremiah in chapter 8 when he says, I'm broken by the brokenness of my dear people. And he grieved over how they were superficially saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Because that's what my family tried to do. It's
keep
like,
peace, yeah.
Like, move on, let's make everything okay again. But it wasn't true. And yet that was just people trying to survive. It wasn't...
Wasn't malicious.
No, no. And you know, and then there's the whole problem with the school. And I remember at one point my mom turned around and said, people have told us that we should file a lawsuit. But I don't want to do that because it won't bring him back. So that stuck with me. And that's one of the evidences of her faith that she just... And it was very hard on the school. It was very hard on the people who started the school.
Absolutely.
And when, in fact, the girl, they had left 30 children in the care of a 16-year-old girl during recess when he vanished. And it was his first day, so she didn't know him. She didn't notice when he disappeared. But she was not okay. She had...
That was on her conscience.
Oh, yeah. I heard from somewhere that she had tried to kill herself. But when I went to that girls' school, apparently her younger sister was in that girls' school, which is so bizarre. But at one point in the school, which was not a good place for me, I did a lot of wandering around by myself. But at some point I was walking and I came around a corner and there were a whole group of girls standing there listening. And the girl who used to be my friend was talking and telling them some story. And, you know, I came up behind just wondering what she was talking about. And again, my Spanish wasn't that great, but I was listening, trying to understand. And then she turned, she said, "Oh, stop, she's here."
Oh, gosh.
And then I realized she was telling them my story of my little brother. Yeah, so that was unpleasant.
Now, did you also kind of stick out visibly as a white girl in the school, or were there other light, fair-skinned Americans?
They were all light-skinned. These are like rich kids,
right,
who are mostly
higher economics
Spanish
class.
Or European descent.
But you're the only American.
I was the only American, and I look different because there is a difference.
Right.
And I was not Catholic.
Yeah.
That was a bigger difference even. But yeah, no, they were mean, you know, this was junior high, you know how kids can be.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a safe place, not a healthy place. Plus I'd always been like top grade student, loved to learn. And here I could barely speak the language.
Yeah.
So I was just
skirting by.
Barely.
Yeah.
It was out of mercy that they passed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked so small. There's a funny story. The director was a nun that everybody was afraid of. I don't know why, but she saw me once walking down the hallway, and she would stand in this place where she could look over all the kids in the hallway, and she saw me. I saw her catch me, and then she came marching toward me with this angry look on her face, and I remember thinking, uh-oh, you know, I didn't even know what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have enough Catholic background to know if that was a threat, but she looked threatening. Anyway, she came at me and she grabbed my hand and took off with me. No words spoken. And just dragging me along. And we went up some stairs and down some stairs and through some hallways and up some stairs and down some stairs. And finally, we get over to the grade school. And she's coming up to these teachers and saying, "Is this your student? Is this your student?" And I kept saying, I don't belong here. I go over there. And with what Spanish I had.
Oh my gosh.
And finally, one of the teachers recognized me and said, "No, she's in secondary. She goes over there." And so she turned to look at me and she said, "Go back to your classroom," and just let go.
Okay.
And I wandered around trying to find my way back.
No. Oh, sorry about that.
No, she didn't apologize.
Oh, man.
No.
So how long were you in Mexico? Because I know you moved at some point. You ended up in Israel. At some point, you came back to the U.S., so.
Yes. Yes.
How long did you stay in Mexico, and then where was the next move to?
Well, I was in Mexico through high school, which is a prep school.
Right.
And I went to college there and I worked there while I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
Then I moved back to the States at the age of 20 and I came to the UW. But one more thing I want to mention about the years in Mexico. It was hard. I'm sorry, I'm telling the hard stuff.
It's okay.
You're all right.
There was a fair amount of injustice. There was injustice in the society that was really hard for me to handle.
Mm-hmm.
But also there were people in authority who were unjust towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just because of being an American. It was because of being a woman and being smart. They did not like that. So I had teachers that would tell me, "I don't like you." Like I had a math teacher that no matter what I did, my assignments, my tests could all be perfect with no mistakes, but he always give me the lowest grade. So in Mexico,
like,
that was 60, so I got 60
like,
on everything.
Mathematics is fairly objective in the results here. How do you give me somebody a 60?
No, I challenged him a few times and he said, "Well, that's what you deserve." And then there was one time where on a test, was it a test or a report, anyway, my best friend and I, we compared our tests. She had an A and I had, you know, whatever the lowest is, D minus.
Mm-hmm.
It was 60.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, "Well, we should just go talk to him." So we went to talk to him and showed him the two papers. And he took her paper and wrote 60 on it.
Oh my gosh. What an abusive
man.
Party.
And then in college, mind you, college, you don't expect it. But I was in a programming class, which I was already working as a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
That's computer sciences. But this teacher had taken a dislike to me, and he people in my group, he'd given everyone an A and he gave me a B. And so I asked him, he said, does anyone think their grade is unfair? And he was looking at me and I said, well, yes. I said, why did you give the other people on my team an A and you gave me a B? And he said, that was a mistake and that was unfair. You deserve an A. I'll fix it. But then he didn't. And then I ran into him a few weeks later in a party of all places. I was thinking, what are you doing at a party with my friends? But he came up to me and had a drink. He came up to me and he's like grinning and laughing. And he said, do you know why I did that to you? And I said, I don't think I said anything because this was not unusual for people to come up and lay it on me. I just looked at him and waited because I knew it was coming. And he said, because I don't like you.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's just laughing. And he's nothing you can do now. And that was when I decided. Mm. I thought, I've got to get out of here. Mm. I can't handle it here anymore. Yeah. I had a boss that would change my programs then over the weekend. And then he'd tell me on Monday morning, your program failed. Mm. I had to come in and fix it for you. And I'd say, why did it fail? And he'd said, well, I put this in. But he would tell everybody else in the company that my programs weren't working.
So there was just a lot of...
It was intentional needling, and, you know.
Bullying.
Yeah. So your overall view of your time in Mexico then is...
I know it sounds negative, but it wasn't.
Like there was a lot of negative. Where did... I'm curious.
How were the street tacos?
We sort of skipped from, you know, grade school and secondary school to college. What happened with your faith between those times? Did anything develop there, or what happened with you and Jesus? And because I know you said you had this encounter in a dream, and you looking back now saying, I didn't really know him.
I didn't.
What was there any sort of development from, you know, then to skipping ahead to college? What was your faith like at that point?
My mom found a Lutheran church that she felt at home in. And so I was going to church there with her. I ended up being confirmed as a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because in the Lutheran church, you're confirmed on Pentecost. Mm-hmm. And later on, when I found out what Pentecost meant, I was thinking, well, it sure wasn't like that for me. But I think it just was something to do.
I had a conviction
of God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jesus was a part of the package. He's in the Bible. And I liked to read the Bible. Mm-hmm. I read quite a bit. Without understanding a lot of it. And I did end up making wonderful friends and having some really good experiences there. And my family did make some progress and things did get better. And I became super fluent in Spanish. And I'm actually really thankful for my time there. So yeah, I don't want to give the impression that I wasn't. But there was a time when I stopped going to church because, I won't tell another negative story. Something happened, and I just told my mom, I don't want to go back. And she said, I don't blame you. Mm-hmm. So I didn't go back. And that was when I started to become more interested in, you know, spiritual things that are not godly.
Okay.
And I don't think that was very good for me. It's just curiosity.
Yeah.
But I liked to talk about things. I liked to be pondering truth. We had a philosophy class in prep school, and so there were several people in my high school that I would talk to about philosophy, and you know, we'd like to have those kind of discussions.
Of course, heady discussions. Yes.
Yeah. So that was part of my journey of faith. But I think my conviction, I don't know. I don't think I realized quickly that I was lost. I think it was a very slow progression.
Okay.
When I moved here. Mm-hmm.
What made you come to UW? I'm curious.
Well, my older brother had ended up living here, and he'd gone to UW. Mm-hmm. My grandparents wanted me to be in either Texas or Oklahoma, and I hadn't had good experiences in those places and didn't really want to live there. Mm-hmm. And up here was beautiful. I came for a visit.
Of course.
And I thought, no, I'd rather go up there. And of course, by the time I got here, my brother wasn't here anymore. But that's okay. I mean, I was still happy to be here. But the hard thing here, this is the funny thing. Like, my best friend in Mexico, she quoted this to me recently, and I had forgotten. She said that I said, when I went back to visit, when I lived here, I thought I was American. Mm-hmm. But when I moved there, I realized I wasn't.
You weren't American. Yeah.
And
you were sort of a third culture kid.
Definitely yeah. third culture kid. And I didn't have a home culture. I didn't have a mm-hmm. home. I didn't have a sense of belonging, especially here. So I really wasn't able to make friends. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand the humor, the sense of humor. I didn't know any of the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand football. I hadn't seen any of the commercials.
A lot of people don't understand football, but
I thank you. Yeah, no, football is actually soccer here. No, just kidding. So it was actually really tough the first year I was here. I felt very, very much an outsider.
Was that largely, you think that was largely a result of culture here or just the fact that you were in America now? Do you think it had was particular to Seattle area culture or was it just the fact that you had been somewhere where it didn't really have an anchor of home and then came here?
I think it would have been hard wherever I went.
Wherever you went. Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it's harder to make friends here.
Yeah, as a transplant, I sort of agree with you. But I do think there is something there. So you hit the ground here. You get here again. You move here. You think I'll go there because my brother's there. And then you get here. He's no longer here. You came. You're at UW. What happens next?
Well, I was studying computer sciences,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of my classes that I was trying to transfer from Mexico City.
Yeah.
They didn't want to give me credit for them without review. And so mm-hmm. there was some hassle there. And in the meantime, I was taking some classes I needed. But my heart was searching. I used to talk to I was a sucker for anyone who would come and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Scientology people, the Jehovah's Witnesses people, the Moonies. I mean, I would talk to anyone. I felt this sense of being lost and I was wrestling in my heart because I felt like, in fact, this is kind of a funny story. I decided I needed a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Tower Books down in Queen mm-hmm. Anne area. And I didn't want anyone to see me getting a Bible. So I went around grabbing this book and that book. I got like 5 books. And
you put the Bible in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, I hadn't, when I got to the Bible section.
Why did
section,
you not want anyone to think that you were a Christian? Or
I don't know
weirdo,
what it was.
Or?
It was just like when my mom says, do you know who that was? And I said, no. I mean, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I don't know why. Yeah. I just had that in me. It was ridiculous. But I got to the section next to the Bibles. It's not like they would have a big section in Tower Books. So I was at the spirituality section and I was glancing over, looking at the Bibles. Mm-hmm. And I saw one that didn't look like a Bible because it had a jean jacket cover.
Oh.
And I thought,
denim Bible.
Yes.
Nice. Very popular.
And I and I reached down and grabbed that and stuck it in between the books, very nonchalantly when no one was in the aisle. Then I go up to the front to pay for my books.
And they said, price check on the Bible. Yeah, no.
It was basically that. He's going through the books and then he holds it up like this. And he's like, hey, Joe, how much is this Bible? And I was just mortified and I could hardly get out of there.
That's hilarious.
But so I got that book home and I was thinking that reading it might calm my, stress. But I couldn't read it. It's like I would open it up. It had red letters. I'd be looking at the red letters. And I would see Jesus' name and I would think, it's only 5 letters. Just 5 letters. And because I couldn't understand, I literally couldn't understand anything I read. I couldn't make sense of the sentences. And I don't think it was the translation. I think it was me. And I ended up stuffing it under my pillow, thinking, I don't know, at least it's there.
There you go.
But I had this fear that I was supposed to believe in Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't, because I couldn't.
Oh.
I had no faith. I had no conviction of him as a person. It was just 5 letters.
Mm.
And in the meantime, you know, I'd be having philosophical debates with people. Mm. And, you know, I liked those heady conversations. And my boyfriend lived next to this young woman who was kind of a new Christian. And she was very zealous, you know, and very bold. And she's from New York, from Brooklyn. And she would talk about these things. And one day she decided to chat with me, you know, and I knew the Bible way better than she did, which is hilarious. Here I am. I'm not even able to read it. Mm-hmm. And so I started asking her questions and talking to her. And she's just like shaking her head, looking at me like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then she said, can I go get my book? And I said, sure. So she grabs her Bible and she brings it over and she hands it to me. And I took her Bible and I opened it up and I looked at it. And then I slammed it shut and I handed it back to her. And I said, I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, there is such a beautiful irony of you telling us this story now.
Really?
I just love how God works in our lives because it's just that is the opposite of Suzanne Hagelin, who is just like the most Bible saturated person.
Oh, I love
think
the word.
Know. Yeah. Like that
know,
God would take
funny.
That and turn that around.
Yeah.
You know, praise God.
So
when did it become more than five letters?
Well, I'm getting there.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Anyway, so I started to think in my mind, okay, what am I afraid of? Because I knew I was afraid. I felt like a fly in a spider web that's wrapped up, you know?
You think there was some spiritual warfare?
Definitely.
The enemy's like, I'm just going to try to keep this gal from getting invested
here.
Keep her
and
heady
I was a sucker for
keep,
all
yeah,
these
keep over
wackos.
Here in heady conversations. Let's talk philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk all this stuff out here because this stuff doesn't have a claim on you. You can't
take
it or leave it, but you can't take or leave Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like you kind of have to make
a
choice.
Well, like this one time with the Scientology people, I ended up following them back to their office, and this one guy was talking to me for like 3 hours, and then he made this offhand comment, and he told me all kinds of things, which they apparently don't tell people right off the bat, but I knew a lot about the kinds of stuff they were talking about. And weird, you know, aliens and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden he says, that's why I can't believe, excuse my language, all that crap about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said that, it was like my eyes were opened and I felt like I was looking at a demon.
Mm.
And I was filled with terror and all I could think was, I've got to get out of here.
Oh my God. Mm.
And so I got out of there. So yeah, I think there was spiritual stuff happening. Anyway, I decided that what I was afraid of was hell, because I had been to church and I had heard about it. And so then I just, when as soon as I realized that, I thought, oh, well, there's no such thing as hell. Mind you, in my infinite wisdom, I decided.
You decided that there's no objective reality called hell.
That there's no such thing as hell. And so I thought, oh, well, then I have nothing to be afraid of.
How'd that work?
Well, I felt better for a few weeks.
A few weeks. Nice.
Yeah, and then I had a dream. I had a dream within a dream.
Mm.
And in the second dream, I was like in the future and just going through my life, ordinary life. And a voice was talking to me and it was saying, this is your life. And I was thinking, well, not bad. You know, things seem to be working out for me. I'm assuming that means that I don't know, got the job I wanted or friends I wanted or whatever. My life seemed to be okay. And I was like nodding like, whoa, this is really cool. You know, the idea of a voice telling me about the future, it felt cool. So I'm walking along and I come into this big like room. It's like a public area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking around from side to side. And then I look up and there's a very distinctive ceiling over my head. It's like a high dome with these cross beams going over the dome. And the voice said, go north. And I woke up. So I got up, got ready for work. I felt like there was a real urgency.
But you woke up in reality, not woke up from the dream inside a dream? Or you're still dreaming or you're awake actually now?
Yes, that's a very wise question. I believed that I was awake, but I was not.
Mm.
So I woke up, got ready for work, went on with my life, and I kept thinking, feeling this sense of urgency. I have to figure it out what it means, because it means something. And I don't know what it means, but, you know, and sometimes I tell people about it, because it's kind of cool having this dream about the future, and, yeah, I dream the future, and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went by, I lost the sense of urgency, and I didn't figure out what it meant. And one day I was walking along talking with someone, and I walked into this public building, and I look around, and I thought, this looks really familiar. And then I lifted my eyes and I saw that ceiling. And right then, like something being turned off, I found myself in the presence of God without a word to say for myself. And I was filled with terror. And I was screaming, oh my God, it's too late. It's too late. Mm. And even in the moment I was just beginning to experience that horror, I woke up again in my room. And as I came awake, I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what year it was. I did not understand that it had all been a dream because it was so vivid. But the terror of hell was upon me, and I knew that that terror was to be left without that covering that Jesus. I didn't think this coherently, but that's what it was. It's like, here's what it's like to be with God without anything to say for yourself. It's not that he won't welcome anyone. It's that we can't bear to be near him unless we have that. So I felt this horror, this terror upon me, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So it was early in the morning, like 5 a.m. I took a bus downtown and I caught a ferry over to Bainbridge Island, and I walked up the beach and I sat down in a chair on the beach. Sat there all day trying to figure out, and I remember thinking, now I understand the meaning of original sin. I don't know why that was the thought, but anyway, so the next day I was at my boyfriend's house, and this neighbor girl woman comes over. And she took one look at me and she said, "You look upset." And I just burst into tears, you know. So she said, "Let's go find a quiet place." So we found a quiet place and I told her the whole story. She was just smiling. And she said, "Jesus is calling you." And I said, "But what does he want?" It's like, I don't know what it means. And she said, "When you think of north, which way is north?" And, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know, is it that way? And she's like, no. I mean, like, on a map. I was just shaking my head. I said, I don't know. And you have to understand, I was undone. I mean, I literally, I couldn't have survived another few days of that state that I was in, because I was such a mess. And I couldn't think. I just couldn't think of what she meant. And she said, "Well, is it like this?" And she pointed her finger towards the sky. She said, "Is that what it means to go north?" And to me, it felt like this huge revelation. I was like, "Oh, yes, that's it." And she said, "Jesus is calling you." And I said, "I don't know what he wants." So she just said, "Look, let's just pray. And you can just ask Jesus into your heart." And I was like, "Okay, you tell me what to do." And so she led me in a sinner's prayer. Mm-hmm. And when it was over, I kept saying to her, "Is that enough?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Are you sure that's enough?" And she said, "Yes." And I noticed over the next few hours that Jesus had become a person to me. I'm not going to describe it, but I had a nightmare that night that was pretty evil that made me convinced that I had escaped. Just by the skin of my teeth. So,
escape judgment.
And escaped the enemy's plan for me.
Death.
Yeah. Anyway, my life, and I've always been kind of a good person, you know. It's not like I had huge wicked things to repent of, but I was, of course, a sinner in a million ways, as there's no question. But I had a huge conversion change. It was a dramatic change in my life. Overnight, dramatic change. And my love for Jesus, who rescued me, is unchanged. I never forget his mercy. Mm. And even though that whole thing was like a dream, I experienced it as if he had snatched me out of hell and put me back in time to give me another chance. That's how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. What was it that compelled that transformation? Because I think if it, you know, an overnight thing, did the Bible start making sense to you? Did this lady who prayed with you, did she kind of become a guide or point you in a certain way? Or was it just a response of gratitude? What would it look like?
We ended up being roommates.
Okay.
And, you know, she was a pretty new believer, too. She was had only been a Christian about 6 months or something. Mm-hmm. And she had some difficulties, you know. I mean, I thought that she could be a guide to me, but we were all kind of in the same boat, you know.
She could where you were, you know.
She walked into the bathroom in a bar once, and there was a woman in there crying. She led her to Christ. This is just, God just kept
giving
her this.
Some people have those opportunities and those giftings, and it's amazing.
Yes, but she's a dear, beloved mm-hmm. sister and friend. We started going to Calvary Fellowship with Wayne Taylor, and that was a real blessing for us. Mm-hmm. That's where I ended up meeting my husband, Jack, which that story, I don't know if you guys have heard, but he was he had been in Israel, and he wanted to go back. And one of my roommates wanted to go to Israel, and then there was another guy who wanted to go back to Israel. And so they were all going to study Hebrew together. And I said, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
So we did this little class in our house. Mm-hmm. And within a few weeks, Jack had decided that I was the one for him. And he used to ask me every class to marry him in Hebrew. And then I'd say, well, I don't know what that means. And he'd say, you need to study more. You need to do your homework.
That's so coy, Jack.
I know.
Man.
Anyway, that's one of the reasons that I ended up going to Israel. I mean, I know there's a lot to cover. We're probably running out of time.
Oh, yeah, but that's fine. I mean, this is incredible stuff to talk about. We could do a part two at some point, but I want to ask maybe a good summation question for this part. At that point where, you know, you have this conversion experience where Jesus becomes more than five letters to you, what did that do to your perspective of the way that your life had gone before? Were you able to look back and see the Lord working on you or working, reaching out to you? Were you able to go see the Lord's hand there?
Yeah.
Before that happened, where, I mean, it sounds, because again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you had a lot of experiences that might embitter somebody. Was there a bitterness there, or were you just kind of rolling with the punches as they came? What did that?
I don't think that I'm a bitter person. Mm-hmm. There have been very few times in my life when I've struggled mm-hmm. with that. I definitely saw his hand. Even before I realized that, oh, I'm lost, I saw his hand in my life and his kindness to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was a person who held it together to try to be there for the family, other members of my family were actually, they actually had this idea of me that I wasn't hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And that I wasn't wounded by what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there was bitterness on their part towards me.
Oh, okay.
And so I never saw myself as poor me. It was more of I feel like a privileged person. And mm-hmm. I don't know why things are easier for me. They weren't. But my way of coping was to stuff the pain mm-hmm. and deny that it was there.
Okay.
And it was actually one of the great sorrows of my childhood was to not be understood by my family. Mm. But I don't blame them for that because I know why it happened.
Yeah.
And my heart's desire was for the healing of each member of my family mm-hmm. for decades. I mean, when it was about 6 years ago, I think 6 years ago, we were all here mm-hmm. We were actually at Squim. Everyone except my sister, who had already passed away at that point, we gathered around the dining room table in my parents' house, and I had called this meeting, if you will, and I said, all right, we're going to each tell the story of what happened the day when Philip died.
Mm-hmm.
And each person told their story, And most of the people there didn't know anyone else's story.
Hmm.
And it was pretty
eye-opening, I'm sure.
Intense. I mean, you know, that we never spoke of it. How is that possible?
Yeah, really.
Until, you know,
mm-hmm.
45 years later or whatever it was. How is that? But that was the grace of God that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's okay and we all love each other and we pulled through. Anyway, I definitely saw the Lord's hands. And
yeah.
I'm so thankful. Him speaking to my mom through me saying, Philip's okay, he's with me,
mm-hmm.
made a huge like center in me where I had the conviction that God knew me personally,
mm-hmm.
that he cared about my family, that he could be trusted, that there is a safe place with him, that, and I got this really weird idea that I was going to have a son one day, you know,
mm-hmm.
which don't ask me why. I was talking to him later and it's like, Lord, why do I have this idea? It's not like you said that to me that night. But then afterwards he did speak to me and say, you're going to have a son. And I did like a year later, like probably even 1 year to the day later, my son was born. But it was a bit of I didn't see that coming. Anyway.
You didn't laugh when he told you that?
Yeah. His name's not Isaac.
I know. I could have. I should have. I didn't think of it.
Well, it's such a unique thing to hear that you had a conviction that the Lord was real and was interested in you, but then it all, I don't know, became personal later to you. That's fascinating to me.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's that's like, interesting because usually that's not the way it goes a couple of ways. That's not a common one at all.
Mm-hmm. To feel close to the Old Testament God and to have no connection with Jesus.
But
is a bit
but
of
Jesus
a
is just five letters. Yeah.
Judaism thing happening there.
Oh, man. Well, Suzanne, I know there's a lot more we could talk about. I think we do need to do a part two of this, though, because you have done a whole lot more besides what we've talked about now. But I'm thrilled that the Lord met you where he did, and I'm grateful for your ministry here.
And that he gave you a desire to read the Bible and understand it.
Yes, because that's different
Bible.
Now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing
your
story. Thanks for being vulnerable.
Thanks for listening.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. Suzanne, we'll get a part two on the books here in a little bit, because I know there is more to the many-layered person that is Suzanne Hagelin. I almost called you Hagelin. I'm sorry.
Don't do
Suzanne
that.
Hagelin. For now, we're going to say goodbye, and we will see you again next week, probably with some more stories. We'll see what happens, though. God bless.
Thanks for listening. For more information and resources from Imprint Church, you can download our app or head to imprintchurch.org.